Have you ever felt like learning about some new technology just keeps adding more and more layers of complexity?
I know what you mean.
It can feel really overwhelming, especially when you're digging into a new field or maybe you're putting together a presentation or even just trying to learn something new. It's like drowning in information sometimes.
Yeah, you're not wrong. The digital world is built on like so many levels of abstraction.
Right.
It's valuable to just take a step back sometimes, look at the basic ideas that make everything work.
That's exactly what we're doing in this deep dive, getting down to the essentials. Today, we're looking at something that might surprise you, using memory, the stuff that stores data, to actually perform logic,
That's right.
which is at the heart of how digital circuits work.
Exactly.
I bet some of you are thinking, wait a minute, memory is for storing things.
Yeah, that's what we usually think of.
And you'd be right, in most cases. But we've been going through some interesting material, excerpts from logic synthesis concepts and techniques, and a book called Memory-Based Logic Synthesis. And it turns out that you can actually use different types of memory to implement some pretty complex logic.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting thing about it.
Right.
This approach is that it gives you a lot of flexibility and you can program it too.
Okay.
So instead of having all these logic gates hardwired with transistors, we're essentially just programming the logic directly into these memory cells.
Okay, so let's break this down for everyone listening. Our goal today is to understand the fundamental principles of memory-based logic synthesis. We'll look at its uses and also why it's such a significant approach in modern digital design, especially with things like FPGAs, those field programmable gate arrays. So where do we even begin to think about logic using memory?
Well, I think we should start with the building blocks that are discussed in the sources. Things like different kinds of memory, programmable logic arrays, PLAs, content addressable memories, CAMs, and then, of course, the field programmable gate arrays or FPGAs. They all have their own roles in this approach.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
When we talk about memory, we're not just talking about the RAM in our computers, right?
Yeah.
What kinds of memory are we talking about for this?
Well, one that comes up in the source is dynamic random access memory. DRAM. And that's really great for storing huge amounts of data.
Okay.
It uses a very simple design, just one transistor per bit, but the circuitry around it can be kind of complex and it needs to be refreshed constantly to hold the data. So it's not really ideal for implementing logic functions on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
For that, static RAM or SRAM is often a better choice.
Okay, got it.
And SRAM cell, you can think of it like a tiny latch that holds a state as long as you're giving it power.
Okay.
So it's super fast for accessing logic values.
Okay, so for like massive storage,
Yeah.
DRAM makes sense. But for logic, which needs things to happen quickly on a smaller scale, SRAM's the way to go.
Yeah.
Now, what about these PLAs?
PLAs.
I heard they're used in like older computers.
Yeah.
What
Write it
are they
out.
exactly?
Yeah, programmable logic arrays or PLAs were often found in the control units of those early microprocessors. So basically, a PLA has two main parts, an AD array and an OR array.
Yeah.
You can program these arrays to create logic functions in sum of products form, which is a way of combining ANIM operations with OR operations.
Okay.
They talk about both static and dynamic PLAs in the source, with dynamic versions often being preferred for bigger designs to save on power and size.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting, there were even these rewritable PLAs that had like a switch and a memory element at each intersection.
Wow.
So those are kind of an early form of programmable logic.
Okay.
You could have a flexible circuit before they even came up with these fancy FPGAs.
So you're physically creating connections within those arrays to represent the A and D parts of the logic, and then you join those results together with the OR part.
That's right.
It's like a physical way to visualize it.
It is.
Now, CAM, content addressable memory, that sounds completely different.
It is quite different. Great
Instead of
point.
giving it an address, you give it the data, and it tells you where it is.
Right.
It's almost like the reverse of how our computer's main memory works.
Exactly. That's the key difference. You don't give it an address to find the data. You give it the data, and then it searches to find a match and tells you the address.
That's amazing.
The source talks about two main types: binary CAM, BSAM, which is for exact matches, just zeros and ones, and
Yeah.
then ternary CAM, TCM. TCM is powerful because it adds a third state. They call it X or don't care, and it can match both a zero and a one.
Okay.
So don't care lets you do more general pattern matching.
Okay.
And that's really helpful in network routing where you don't always need to check every single bit in an address.
All right.
Like if you're routing internet traffic, you might only care about the first part of an IP address to know which network to send it to.
Ah, the don't care state opens up a lot of possibilities for pattern matching. But the source also said that TTECAMs use a lot more transistors compared to normal SRAM.
Yes, that's a trade-off.
Okay.
To store one bit, SRAM usually needs around 6 transistors, but a TSIMCAM cell can need more than 16.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, KeySCAM is more expensive and it uses more power for the same amount of storage compared to SRAM.
Yeah.
But the fact that you can search based on content, especially with the don't care state, makes it really valuable for certain applications, like high performance things, network routers, or anytime you need super fast lookups.
Okay, so it's a trade-off between flexibility and cost.
Exactly.
Depends on what you need it for.
Right.
Okay, lastly, we have the FPGAs. These are the chips that can be reprogrammed after they're made, really.
Exactly. Field programmable gate arrays. You can actually reconfigure them even after they've been manufactured. So the architecture is often called island style.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine like a grid of logic blocks connected by programmable connection blocks and switch blocks.
Okay.
The logic blocks do the computation, and inside a lot of these blocks is something called a lookup table, or LUT.
LUTs. We hear that term all the time with FPGAs.
You do.
So what are they really?
Well, the source says that a LUT is basically a small asynchronous memory.
Okay.
And, you know, for like a K input LUT, it can handle any possible logic function of those K inputs. So picture a tiny truth table that's stored in memory.
Okay.
The inputs act as the address.
Okay.
And the stored value at that address is the output of the logic function.
Okay, I'm following.
Now, unlike a larger, more general purpose memory, the output from an LUT is usually available very quickly, and it doesn't even need a clock signal.
Okay.
That's why they call it asynchronous. FPGAs used to use 4 or 5 input LUTs, but now 6 input LUTs are much more common.
So a 6 LUT is just a really tiny memory, and it can store the truth table for any logic function with up to 6 inputs.
That's it.
That is a clever way to get programmable logic.
Yeah.
You also mentioned interconnection, the fabric.
Yeah.
And the source says that that's a really big part of modern FPGAs.
Absolutely. In today's FPGAs, the connection blocks and switch blocks, they can take up over 90% of the chip's area.
Wow.
So efficiently routing those signals between logic blocks is just as important as the blocks themselves when you're creating these digital circuits.
Makes sense.
Oh, and it's important to remember that a lot of FPGAs, the ones you can buy, they also have these dedicated embedded memory blocks in addition to the LUT-based logic.
Okay, so we've covered the basics, different kinds of memory. We've talked about PLAs, that really programmable logic, CAMs for searching based on content, and then FPGAs that use LUTs, which are like tiny memories, as their reinfigurable units.
Right.
Now, how do we go from these individual building blocks to implementing more complex logic functions?
Okay, this is where the big idea of functional decomposition comes in.
Okay.
The source talks about it as like the foundation of memory-based logic design.
Uh-huh.
Imagine you've got this huge, complex logic function
cool.
with a lot of inputs. If you tried to implement that with one massive memory, it just wouldn't be practical.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because the size of the memory grows so fast with more inputs.
Right.
So functional decomposition, it gives us a way to break down this big function into smaller memory units that are connected to each other. Think of those LUTs in FPGAs.
Right.
Instead of one giant memory, we use a network of smaller ones.
It's like dividing and conquering.
It is.
Now, the source mentions this thing called the weight of a logic function.
Yeah.
And representing it with a sum of products expression. What's that all about? So the weight is like how often the function outputs a true or a one. Is that right?
That's a good way to think about it.
Okay.
More formally, though, the weight of a function is the number of input combinations that give you a non-zero output.
Okay.
Or a one output.
Got it.
And the sum of products expression is a standard way to write a logic function, basically O-ring a bunch of any terms together.
Okay.
This form is important for understanding how PLAs are programmed.
How does this functional decomposition actually work in practice? Mm. The source talks about these decomposition charts.
Right.
With bound and free variables. It sounds kind of abstract.
Okay, so imagine a decomposition chart as a way to visualize how to break down a function.
Okay.
So for a function with, let's say, n inputs, you can split those inputs into two groups.
Uh-huh.
Bound variables and free variables. The bound ones are used to, like, index the columns of the chart, and the free ones index the rows.
Okay.
Then each cell represents the output of the function for a specific combination of those variables.
Okay, so it's like a grid.
It is.
Okay.
And the column multiplicity is how many different column patterns you have in that chart. Theorem 3.3.1 tells us that the number of lines you need to connect the blocks in a decomposed function is directly related to this column multiplicity.
All right.
So if you look at figures 3.3.1, 3.3.2 in the source, they show a visual representation of this.
Okay.
It's like each unique pattern in the column represents a subfunction,
right,
and that needs to be created.
So by looking at those patterns,
yeah,
we can figure out how to best split the function and then how many connections we'll need between the resulting memory blocks.
That's right.
Okay. The source also mentions lemma 3.3.2, which says there might be multiple ways to decompose the same function.
Right.
Okay.
Lemma 3.3.2 highlights that there's no one right way to do this. Depending on how you choose your bound and free variables, you can get different decompositions.
Okay.
This gives you more flexibility in how you actually implement the logic with memory.
And then there's a brief mention of binary decision diagrams, BDDs, and quasi-reduced ordered BDDs, QROBDD,
yes,
as ways to represent and break down functions?
Yeah, those are just different graphical ways to represent Boolean functions.
Okay.
Really helpful for analyzing logic.
Okay.
Example 3.4.2 and figures 3.4.3 and 3.4.4 show how the structure of these diagrams is closely related to functional decomposition and the column multiplicity.
Yeah.
So for a specific order of the input variables, the nodes in a QROBDD correspond to the different column patterns in the decomposition chart.
Got it. So we can take this complex function, break it down into smaller pieces using functional decomposition.
Yeah.
And then those pieces can be implemented using memory units like the LUTs and FPGAs.
Right.
So then how do you connect these LUTs together to create the full decomposed function?
Okay, well, if you apply this decomposition over and over again,
uh-huh,
you can create a cascade of LUTs.
Okay.
Where the output of one LUT feeds into the next one, and the source shows that in figure 5.1.2.
Right.
That lets us implement functions that have way more input variables than a single LUT could handle.
Okay, that's where the C measure comes in, right? It tells us how complex a Boolean function is, specifically when we're using a cascade of LUTs.
Right. The C measure basically tells you how efficiently you can implement a function using these interconnected LUTs.
Okay.
So functions with a small C measure can be done with pretty compact LUT cascades. Lemma 5.1.3 connects this back to the decomposition by showing how the column multiplicities in each step affect the overall C measure.
So if a function has a low C measure, we can probably implement it with a fairly simple LUT chain.
Right.
What about specific types of functions? The source mentions symmetric functions in their C measure.
Yeah, symmetric functions.
Yeah.
Those are functions where the output stays the same, even if you change the order of the inputs.
Oh, okay.
So lemma 5.3.1 says there's an upper limit to the C measure for those kinds of functions.
Okay.
It's related to about half the number of input variables.
Okay.
And they give you an example in the source. Example 5.3.1, it's a six-variable function, shows how that symmetry limits the number of unique column patterns you get in the decomposition chart.
Okay, so symmetry in the function can help us make more efficient memory-based implementations.
Exactly.
Now, there's a whole chapter in the book about index generation functions.
Yeah.
What are those?
Okay, index generation functions, think of them as a way to create address tables.
Okay.
They take a big input value and map it to a smaller index.
Okay.
Which is used to quickly find information that's stored in memory.
Oh, got it.
The source talks about a lot of real-world applications where this is super important.
Like what kinds of applications? I know they gave a bunch of examples.
Okay, yeah. So one important one is in those internet routers.
Uh-huh.
For IP address table lookup.
Right.
IPv4 uses 32-bit addresses, and a router has to very quickly find the right routing info for each packet.
Yeah.
So this function can take that 32-bit address and make a smaller index.
Okay.
And that points to the correct entry in the routing table, which is stored in memory.
That makes sense.
Another one is packet filtering.
Okay.
There you need to really quickly identify packets based on certain rules.
Right.
So instead of searching this whole giant table every time,
yeah,
you use the index generator to find the right entry super fast.
So you're using that index as a shortcut to get to what you need.
Exactly.
Okay. What other examples did they give?
Well, there are terminal access controllers, TTACs.
Okay.
They're in local area networks.
Uh-huh.
A TAC checks if a device has permission to access things.
Okay.
Now, each device has this unique MACI address.
Yeah.
It's 48 bits.
Okay.
And there are a ton of possible MACI addresses.
Right.
So an index generator can take that 48-bit address and create a much smaller index.
Okay.
Which is then used to access a memory.
Got it.
And that memory stores the access permissions for the terminals.
Okay, so you're just shrinking that 48 bits down into something smaller to
Yeah.
make it easier to look up.
Right.
Okay.
And then there are memory patch circuits.
Okay.
So when you need to update the firmware in a ROM, in a read-only memory,
Yeah.
you don't have to replace the entire ROM chip. Instead, you can use an index generator to redirect certain ROM addresses to a smaller patch memory.
Oh,
It's
interesting.
like a little update,
Okay.
and that's where the updated data is stored.
Okay, so you're using it to point to a different part of the memory that
Exactly.
has the updates.
Yeah, this technique can also be used when they're making chips.
Oh, okay.
To deal with defects in large memory chips, it helps improve the yield.
That's a really clever way to deal with those manufacturing issues. They also talked about the periodic table as an example, right?
They did. It was a way to understand the concept.
Okay.
You could have an index generator that takes a chemical symbol,
Uh-huh.
and that can be represented with only a few bits,
Okay.
and it outputs the atomic number,
Okay.
which is also just the small number of bits.
Right.
Then that number is used as an address
Okay.
to look up other properties of that element in a regular memory.
Okay.
They also talked about an English-Japanese dictionary
Okay.
where the generator could take an English word and it would output an index.
Okay.
That points to the Japanese translation in a memory.
Got it. So these examples show how useful it is to map these big input spaces,
Right.
which are often sparsely populated,
Right.
down to smaller, more efficient index spaces for accessing memory.
Exactly.
What are some of the common features of these functions that make them so good for these tasks?
Okay, well, they usually produce distinct non-zero output values.
Okay.
And the number of these outputs is usually a lot smaller than the total number of possible inputs.
Yeah.
That's that sparse aspect we were talking about.
Right.
And they often have to work super fast, like in network routing.
Yeah.
And finally, you often need to be able to update the mapping data,
Okay.
especially in things like communication networks and security systems.
So how does the C measure we talked about earlier relate to these index generation functions?
Right.
Lemma 9.7.1 gives us an upper limit.
It does. It says that the C measure of an index generation function with a weight of m, which means it has m non-zero outputs, is at most m plus one.
Okay.
So that means that as long as the number of mappings isn't, insanely huge, the C measure stays pretty manageable,
Okay.
and you can still do memory-based implementations like those LUT cascades.
The source also introduces the concept of beta lambda elements to implement these functions. What are those?
Okay, so they define it as a logic block that can handle any logic function with beta inputs and lambda outputs. It's basically like a super general form of an LUT.
Okay.
Then theorem 9.8.1 says you can implement any n-input index generation function with a weight of m as a multi-level network of these elements.
Okay.
The number of elements you need is related to m and lambda. So it's a way to think about building these index generation functions from these basic memory-like blocks.
So like a network of these generalized LUTs
Right.
can effectively create the mappings we need for index generation.
Exactly.
Now, what happens if the weight of a function is super high?
Okay, well, when the number of non-zero outputs, that weight, gets really big,
Uh-huh.
those LUT cascades we talked about, they can grow too quickly and they're not practical anymore.
Great.
So they introduce this idea of hash-based synthesis.
Okay.
And it uses a hash function
Okay.
to shrink down the number of input variables you need for the memory lookup.
Okay.
They have a good analogy in example 10.1.1 about finding an employee's name from a phone number.
Okay.
So instead of having this gigantic table with every possible phone number, you use a hash function to map it to a smaller index in a more manageable table.
It's like using a hash as a shortcut to get to the right spot.
Yeah.
But with hash functions, you can run into collisions, right?
Yeah.
What if two different inputs map to the same index?
You're right, that can happen.
Okay.
The source talks about using things like linked lists to store multiple entries that hash to the same index.
Okay.
It adds some complexity,
Right.
but it's still a lot more efficient than using this enormous lookup table.
Yeah, makes sense.
They also talk about using linear transformations as another way to reduce the number of variables.
So both hashing and linear transformations are useful for handling functions with a large weight by simplifying the memory lookups.
Exactly.
Now, the source also mentions something called an index generator unit, or IGU.
Right, and figure 10.7.1 shows a possible design for an OGU.
Okay.
It usually has a main memory and maybe an auxiliary memory.
Uh-huh.
So the input goes into a programmable hash circuit, and then the output of that is used as the address to access the main memory.
Okay.
There might also be a comparator to check if the retrieved value actually matches the input, and you can use that auxiliary memory to store additional info or handle those collisions we were talking about.
So it's a more structured way to do index generation, especially when you have a lot of mappings to handle.
Right.
The last big topic in the sources is about reducing the number of variables you need to represent logic functions, especially when using memory. Why is that so important?
Well, reducing the number of variables is crucial because it has a huge impact on the size of the memory you need for the function.
Okay.
So for a function with n inputs, you would need 2 to the power of n storage locations.
Right.
Even a small reduction in n can save you a lot of memory.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Which means lower cost, less power, and potentially faster operation.
Right. It all adds up.
Yeah, and the source talks about how minimization is different for completely specified functions, where every output is defined, versus incompletely specified functions where you have don't cares, where it doesn't matter what the output is for certain inputs.
Right. Those don't cares give us some flexibility in how we define the function.
They do.
How do we know if a function actually depends on a specific input variable?
Well, definition 11.2.3 in the source says that a function depends on a variable if there is at least one pair of input combinations that differ only in that variable and the outputs for those combinations are different.
Okay, so if changing the value of an input doesn't change the output, then that input isn't really needed.
It's exactly. Got it. Then they go on to discuss algorithms for minimizing the variables,
okay,
especially for these incompletely specified index generation functions. And example 11.3.1 shows how you can figure out which input variables are actually needed to distinguish between the specific input vectors.
Okay.
So by looking at which variables need to have different values to create distinct outputs, or in the case of index generation, to map to a valid index, you can get rid of redundant variables.
Right.
And example 11.3.2 shows this with a 7-segment display to BCD converter.
Uh-huh.
It shows that you don't always need to look at all 7 input segments to get the correct output. Some of them might not matter for those specific mappings.
It's like you don't always need all the information to get to the answer.
Yeah, and they mention lemma 11.5.1, which says that if in the decomposition chart, each column has at most one care element, meaning a specified output of either 0 or 1, then you can actually represent the whole function using only the bound variables that index those columns. And then theorem 11.5.3 gives you a lower limit on how many variables you need to represent an incompletely specified index generation function with a specific weight. So basically, by carefully looking at the function and what it's supposed to do, especially when you have don't cares, you can often shrink down the number of variables you need for a memory-based design.
Okay.
And that makes things more efficient and smaller.
It all comes down to understanding the dependencies in the logic.
It does.
And then using the flexibility from those don't care conditions.
Right.
This has been a really fascinating dive into memory-based logic synthesis.
It has.
It's pretty amazing to think that memory, which we usually associate with data storage,
I know, right?
Is so connected to the logic that runs all our digital devices.
Yeah, it's fundamental.
We talked about techniques like functional decomposition, index generation, and variable reduction.
Right.
They give us some powerful ways to use the programmability and flexibility of memory to implement these complex functions.
They do.
And this is especially relevant for modern technologies like FPGAs.
Absolutely.
Their LUTs and embedded memories are so important.
Yeah.
It makes you think about how these principles are at work in all the technology we use every day.
Yeah, it really does.
From FPGAs and embedded systems to those routers that handle all that internet traffic.
Exactly.
Which brings up a question. With all the advances we're seeing in memory tech and the algorithms for logic synthesis, what new innovations might we see in how logic functions are implemented in the future? Could we be moving towards a future where there's even less of a distinction between computation and data storage?
That's a really interesting question to think about.
It is.
And for anyone who wants to learn more, I encourage you to take a closer look at the sources we discussed today.
Definitely.
Or maybe explore some related topics like FPGA design and computer architecture. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Thanks, everyone.